This is Lecture 2 of the series Inflation and Price Controls.
I understand that some of you have been having difficulty with the price level formula that I presented last week, the formula that the general price level equals the aggregate demand for goods divided by the aggregate supply. Now, it may be simply that the words demand and supply are throwing you. So let us use, if you wish, the synonyms spending for demand, the amount of spending, and the quantity of goods sold for supply. They will do as close enough approximations, it will enable you to understand the idea a little better. Now, if you take demand to be the amount of spending and supply the quantity of a good sold, well then, just think very concretely. There is a drugstore down the block that last week perhaps sold 1,000 packs of cigarettes. Now let's imagine that they sold those cigarettes at an average price of $1 per pack. What would be mathematically required to sell 1,000 packs of cigarettes at an average price of $1 a pack? It would be inescapable that they had to sell the total quantity for $1,000. Hold in mind that the average price at which a good is sold is the amount of money spent to buy it divided by the quantity sold. It is that. The only conceivable way that a given quantity of a good, like 1,000 packs of cigarettes, could be sold at a higher average price would be if more money were spent to buy the 1,000 packs. Now just think, suppose there's 1,000 packs that are being sold, and I tell you, this week, the average price will be $2 a pack. What is mathematically required to sell 1,000 packs of cigarettes at an average price of $2 a pack? There must be $2,000 spent. Suppose I tell you that the following week there will be 1,100 packs of cigarettes sold. What would be required to sell 1,100 packs at a price more than $1,000? You would need a greater amount of spending. The spending would have to go up more than in proportion to the quantity. The only way that a price can rise without more spending occurring, the only way it could rise if there were the same spending, would be if less were sold. So the only way our drugstore could sell at an average price above a dollar for and still take in a total of $1,000 would be if it sold fewer than 1,000 packs of cigarettes. Well, I think if you think in terms of these concrete examples and then generalize to the whole economy, think of the entire supply of goods sold, the formula is logically inescapable. It's simply an application of arithmetic. All right, that said, let us begin with this evening's discussion. Last week, I presented the quantity theory of money and showed how the problem of inflation consists in the government's expansion of the money supply. Our job tonight and next week is to examine all of the doctrines advanced as an alternative to the quantity theory of money. Doctrines advanced in an effort to keep the blame for inflation away from the government. Please recall that the quantity theory regards rising demand as the proximate cause of rising prices, and an expanding quantity of money as the cause of rising demand. The doctrines opposed to the quantity theory can accordingly be divided into two groups. First, those which deny that rising demand is the proximate cause of rising prices, and second, those which deny that an expanding quantity of money is the cause of rising demand. Group one is known generically as the doctrine of cost push inflation. This group blames inflation on increases in the costs of production. According to it, costs of production rise, and their rise, quote, pushes up prices, because prices must be raised to cover higher costs. Hence the expression cost push. Now, the cost push doctrine contains three variants, which can be described as the wage push doctrine, the profit push doctrine, and the crisis push doctrine, respectively. The wage push doctrine seeks to blame inflation on the demands of labor unions for higher wages. The profit push doctrine seeks to blame it on the greed of businessmen for higher profits. The crisis push doctrine seeks to blame it on the occurrence of this or that crisis, such as the Russian wheat deal of 1972 or the Arab oil embargo. A further mixed variant is the doctrine of the wage-price spiral, according to which rising prices and wages, once started for any reason, simply mutually feed on each other. The characteristic mark of all of these variants of the cost-push doctrine is that they blame inflation simply on price increases of some kind, including wage increases, and deny the dependency of rising prices on rising demand. Group two, the group that attacks the connection between the quantity of money and demand, contains the various forms of the doctrine that inflation is the result of a more rapid spending of a given quantity of money. In its pure and basic form, it is represented by the doctrine taught to economics students that inflation is the result of a, quote, rising velocity of circulation of money, a faster spending of money, rather than a rising quantity of money. Also included in this group are the doctrines that inflation is the result of inflation psychology, of the use of credit cards, of the granting of installment credit, and of the greed of consumers, or even their mere desire for a better life. Let us begin with a critique of the various cost-push doctrines. We will get to the Group 2 doctrines next week. What I will do in this discussion is the following. First, point 2 in the outline, I will explain the reasoning which leads people to the cost-push doctrines. I will then, point 3 in the outline, explain a major logical deficiency in the attempt to explain rising prices on the basis of rising costs. Next, point 4, I will explain why the cost-push doctrines are equivalent to an attempt to blame inflation on falling supply, which we saw last week is invalid. Following that, I will enter into a detailed critique of each of the specific versions of the cost-push doctrine, starting with the wage-push doctrine. In these discussions, I will show, as my main point, that practically all of the price increases attributed to the operation of cost-push must, in fact, be the result of rising demand and an expanding quantity of money. Let us see now how the supporters of the cost-push doctrines arrive at them. The supporters of these doctrines recognize the validity of the price level formula I presented last week. However, they perceive the role of rising demand in a different way than do the supporters of the quantity theory of money. The supporters of the quantity theory see more demand as a cause of higher prices. The supporters of the cost-push doctrines see more demand not as a cause of higher prices, but as resulting in greater production and supply. In their view, more demand causes correspondingly more production and supply, and therefore does not raise prices. The reason the supporters of the cost-push doctrines believe that more demand causes more supply is that they see the existence of unemployed labor and idle plant capacity. And they assume that so long as unemployment exists, the effect of more demand is simply to enable more people to be employed and therefore for production to be increased. The supporters of the cost push doctrines are willing to concede that more demand is potentially capable of raising prices. But that, they say, could happen only in the context of an economy operating at full employment, and in which, therefore, supply could not be further expanded in response to more demand. At that point, they are willing to admit, more demand would not be accompanied by more supply and would thus drive up prices. The expression they use to describe this situation of more demand driving up prices at the point of full employment is, quote, demand pull inflation, unquote. At the point of full employment, they say, more demand pulls up prices. This so-called demand pull inflation is the only potential influence of more demand on prices that they recognize. To them, demand as a cause of inflation means, quote, demand pull inflation. I put it in quotes because it is their expression, not mine. Now, please observe what the supporters of the cost push doctrine have done in their minds. They have decided that more demand is only capable of raising prices at the point of full employment. They have decided that short of full employment, the effect of more demand is not higher prices, but more employment and more supply. These are the assumptions they bring with them when they observe the facts of the last 30 years. They observe that since World War II, our economic system has not operated at full employment. As a result, they conclude they are free to dismiss rising demand as a cause of rising prices in the United States. Because, as I explained, they have already relegated more demand as a possible cause of rising prices to the arbitrarily limited context of full employment. They assume more demand could only operate at the point of full employment, and that is all. It is on this basis that they turn to the various forms of the cost push doctrine as an explanation of the rising prices that we have experienced since World War II. In their eyes, more demand can't explain these price increases, so some other explanation must be found. The reason rising costs are taken as the explanation is because, in fact, the prices of many goods are determined in the first instance on the basis of their cost of production, as we will see in later lectures. I must say, however, that we will also see in later lectures that all prices determined by cost of production are ultimately determined by supply and demand. So there is no contradiction involved in my conceding the role of cost of production in determining prices, and simultaneously arguing that all prices are determined by supply and demand. Cost of production, we will see, and this point is relevant now, is always based on prices, including wages, which are the price of labor. For example, the cost of producing a bicycle is based on the wages of the bicycle workers, the price of the steel that goes into the bicycle, and so on. It follows that cost of production can never be an ultimate explanation of prices, but just an explanation of some prices on the basis of other prices. For example, an explanation of the price of the bicycle on the basis of the prices of the labor and steel and so forth that are used to produce it. The fact that cost of production is not an ultimate explanation of prices, I must point out, constitutes a very major logical deficiency of the cost push doctrine. This is point three in the outline. Because what the cost push doctrine is actually claiming is that some prices rise because other prices rise, and it is content to leave matters at that. For example, it is typical of the supporters of the cost push doctrine to blame inflation on such things as the rise in the price of steel or the rise in wages achieved by various unions. They do not offer any explanation of what makes possible the higher price of steel or the higher wages obtained by the unions. In fact, what the cost push doctrine boils down to claiming is that certain key prices, and this includes wages, rise arbitrarily without any explanation other than the greed of those who raise them. The cost push doctrine in the last analysis is a doctrine that tries to blame price increases on some form of arbitrary power. It tells us, in effect, that prices rise simply because some powerful people are making them rise. Now, it is true that in our mixed economy, arbitrary power does exist. There are labor union monopolies in a position to force employers to agree to almost any wages they ask. There are also some business monopolies, such as government-franchised electric utilities, though the business monopolies are generally regulated in the prices they can charge. Nevertheless, even the existence of arbitrary power on the part of sellers cannot explain rising prices. I will explain this more fully in our specific discussions of the wage push and profit push doctrines, but the basic reason why arbitrary power on the part of sellers is not a sufficient explanation of rising prices is that such higher prices as it might bring about always cause reductions in the quantity of the good or service that can be sold, and therefore act as a brake on any further such price increases. And this brings me to point four in the outline, and that is that the cost push doctrines are equivalent to an attempt to blame inflation on falling supply. You may have wondered why I spent so much time last week developing the impossibility of falling supply. It's because the majority of economists in the United States today believe implicitly that falling supply is the cause of inflation. What I am out to show is why the cost push doctrine is equivalent to blaming inflation on falling supply. In order to prove this point, which is obviously very important, all we have to do is perform a kind of mental experiment in terms of the price level formula we developed last week. Please recall that the supporters of the cost push doctrines accept this formula, but they believe that more demand is not the factor that raises prices. What raises prices, they say, is cost push, by which they mean, in the last analysis, the arbitrary demands of monopolistic sellers, including labor unions. Accordingly, our mental experiment will consist simply of this. We will assume that monopolistic sellers arbitrarily drive up prices, just as the cost push doctrine claims. And we will also assume that while this rise in prices occurs, there is no change in demand. We make this last assumption because if the rise in demand is really not a factor in raising prices, as the supporters of the cost push doctrine tell us, then its absence can make no difference. So what we have is a rise in prices and a fixed demand, a fixed amount of spending. We can see the results of this experiment as clearly as possible if we think back again to the example we used last week of the hypothetical small economy, which had $10,000 of demand and 1,000 units of supply that were sold at an average price of $10 per unit. Let's take these conditions as our starting point. Now we assume that the $10,000 of demand remains constant. That is, that the spending to buy the goods remains the same at $10,000. And we assume that monopolistic sellers drive up the price level from $10 per unit to some higher amount, say $20 per unit. What must happen? The answer, obviously, is that the supply of goods they sell must fall from 1,000 units to 500 units. And it should be clear that the higher they would drive the price level, the less the goods they could sell. If they drove it to $40 a unit, say, then they could sell only 250 units for the $10,000 of demand. The reduction in the supply sold is proportional to the rise in the price level if demand is fixed. Now let us try to appraise the results of this experiment. we see the quantity of goods sold falling to the same extent that the monopolistic sellers drive up prices. There is no difference between this case and the cases we discussed last week in which a fall in supply raised prices. Please observe that a fall in supply is the necessary condition to the rise in prices in this case. If the quantity of goods sold in our experiment had not been reduced from 1,000 units to 500 units, it would simply have been impossible for the sellers to receive a doubled price. They could not have received any higher price than $10 per unit, since the spending to buy the goods, the demand, remained fixed at $10,000. It is absolutely essential, therefore, for the monopolistic sellers to reduce the supply of goods or services that are sold if they are to drive up prices. If they did not do this, they simply could not raise prices. The monopolistic sellers must hold down supply to raise prices. That is why they want to prohibit other people from selling and to be monopolies in the first place. For example, the reason a monopoly labor union wants to control apprenticeship programs, say, and make it as difficult as possible for people to enter an occupation is that that is a way of restricting supply and thereby making it possible for the union to drive up wages. The fact that the cost push doctrines are the same as an attempt to blame inflation on falling supply totally invalidates them, because it means that all of the objections we saw last week that applied against falling supply as a cause of rising prices apply against cost push as a cause of rising prices. If you recall, we saw that supply has increased rather than decreased, that decreases in supply are not and could not be a cause of a sustained significant rise in prices, short of the speedy disappearance of material civilization. We saw that supply reductions are largely caused by rapid increases in demand, and even in the cases in which they are independent, cannot explain the range of price increases or the effects on debtors and creditors people associate with inflation. And finally, we saw that to call the price increases they produce inflation implied the contradiction that more goods are the cause of poverty. All of these objections apply with equal force against the cost push doctrines. Let us now consider each of the different versions of the cost push doctrine in the light of our knowledge of what the doctrine implies about supply. Let us begin with the so-called wage push version of the doctrine. This is the most plausible version of the doctrine, because what it really refers to are the activities of legally privileged, government-protected labor unions. Such labor unions, as I have indicated, possess monopoly powers in that employers are compelled by law to deal with them and either to meet their wage demands or do without labor. In addition, these unions are often in a position to resort to direct intimidation and violence to back up their demands without fear of legal reprisal. Because of these monopoly powers, the unions are able to set wages as high as they like. Even non-union employers must adopt the pay scale set by the unions, lest their workers decide to unionize, which they can easily do. In this way, the unions are able to drive up wage rates, costs of production, and thus prices throughout the entire economic system. Nevertheless, as bad as this power of the present-day unions is, and as serious as its consequences are, if this were the only factor at work, if it were not joined by an expanding quantity of money and a rising demand, it would not be possible for the unions to exert any long-run or significant influence in making prices rise. In fact, on a long-run basis, prices would probably fall in an economy such as ours, despite the activities of the unions. The fact is that it is only an expanding quantity of money and a rising demand that permit so-called wage push or any other form of cost push to go on pushing very far. The reasons are as follows. If demand, spending, did not rise, if it stayed the same, any increase in the general price level brought about by wage push would be accompanied by a corresponding decline in the supply of goods that could be sold, as we saw a few moments ago in our mental experiment concerning the effects of cost push. This decline in the quantity of goods that could be sold at higher prices would cause a corresponding reduction in the quantity of labor that employers could profitably employ. Because if the quantity of goods employers can sell falls, they obviously require less labor for production. Now, this mounting reduction in the volume of employment offered every time wages and prices were increased would place a limit on the extent to which the unions would drive up wages and prices. So-called wage push inflation would burn itself out in mounting unemployment. Every time a union sought a wage increase, it would have to count the number of its members it was prepared to see added to the ranks of the unemployed. The point would soon be reached where the sheer volume of their own unemployed members would stop further demands on the part even of the worst monopoly labor unions. In order to appreciate just how limited would be the power of monopoly unionism to raise prices without the aid of a larger demand, let us perform another mental experiment. Let us imagine that we have full employment and that demand is fixed. Now let us trace the consequences of the unions driving up the wage and price level by varying amounts. Each time they raise wages and prices, the quantity of goods that can be sold falls. The quantity of labor required in production falls, and the unemployment rate grows. The question we want to ask is, if the unions were willing to drive the unemployment rate to the height that prevailed in the worst years of the 1929 Depression before stopping in their wage demands, how much could they raise prices? The unemployment rate in 1932 and 1933 was about 25% of the labor force. If it took that kind of staggering unemployment rate to stop the further demands of the unions, it would be implied that the maximum cumulative limit by which the unions could raise wages and prices would be one-third. This would produce a 25% unemployment rate. If you want to work it out for yourself, just think of what happens in our hypothetical small economy if the price of a unit of supply rises from $10 to $13.33, an increase of one-third. The effect must be to reduce the number of units that can be sold for $10,000 from 1,000 units to 750 units, a reduction of 25%. The 25% unemployment rate would exist because correspondingly less labor would be required to produce 750 units than 1,000 units. Now, this rise in prices and unemployment might take place all at once, or it might occur gradually over many years, depending on how rapidly or slowly the unions forced up wages. But whether it occurred rapidly or slowly, one-third, or some amount not much greater than a third, and probably quite a bit less, would be the maximum cumulative limit of a rise in prices ascribable to monopoly labor unionism. Because the simple fact is that the ability of the monopoly unions to raise prices is severely limited by the effect of such price increases on the unemployment rate. And it can be safely assumed that even the monopoly unions would be deterred from further wage demands in the face of an unemployment rate at the level of a catastrophic depression. Moreover, once the unions decided to stop their demands and the unemployment rate stabilized at however high a level, prices would probably fall in our kind of economy, as I have stated. The fall in prices would occur as the result of technological progress or any other factor that increased the productivity of labor, that is, which enabled a unit of labor on average to produce more. Increases in the productivity of labor mean that larger supplies of goods are produced by the same number of workers, and that each unit of goods has a lower cost of production because it takes less labor to produce it. A rise in the productivity of labor acts to reduce prices because it means both larger supplies and lower unit costs. It is an offset to wage push. To illustrate the point I am making, assume that after the unions had raised the wage and price level by the limit of a third, the productivity of labor began to increase as the result of the application to production of a series of inventions. Assume that over a period of years, the cumulative effect of these inventions was to double the productivity of labor, the output per worker. In that case, the 3/4 of the labor force that was employed would produce twice as much as it previously did. Prices would fall by half in comparison with the point to which the unions had raised them. And this would mean that they would actually be lower than they were before the unions began their activities. In our example of the hypothetical small economy, they would fall from 1333 to 667, which means they would be a third lower than the $10 level at which they began. To the extent that increases in the productivity of labor occurred at the same time that the unions were driving up wage rates and creating unemployment, their effect would be to offset the rise in costs and decline in production attributable to the unions. It might very well be the case, therefore, that the unions alone would not be able to raise the price level, even temporarily. On the basis of these considerations, we must conclude that it would simply be impossible for monopoly unions, unaided by increases in the quantity of money and rising demand, to make any permanent or significant contribution toward raising the general price level. Indeed, in the absence of an expanding money supply and rising demand, the long-run effect of the unions on the price level, and probably the short-run effect too, would most likely not be to raise it in any absolute sense, but merely to reduce the rate at which it fell. Unaided monopoly unionism, or wage push, is not the cause of rising prices, but of unemployment. As I have shown, the rise in prices it might bring about would probably at most be temporary and could never be of really major significance as price increases go. But the unemployment it creates remains and is of major significance. And this problem of unemployment leads us to the true connection between monopoly unionism and rising prices. Because what the government does when confronted with the prospect of rising unemployment is to inject a larger quantity of money into the economic system. The additional demand that results permits the unions to drive up wages and prices without causing corresponding unemployment. The fact that the quantity of money and demand are made to increase more or less in pace with the wage demands of the unions is the only thing which permits the phenomenon of wage push to continue in existence, because it removes the brake that would otherwise be supplied by a mounting rate of unemployment. In other words, it is the government's expansion of the money supply that is the only thing that allows the unions to go on pushing very far. The government and the economists who support it chronically evade this very necessary, critical role of the expansion of the money supply. As they describe matters, the unions simply drive up wages and prices without limit, and the government has nothing whatever to do with the matter. Its role is merely to urge the unions to exercise restraint. The fact is that the government's expansion of the money supply positively encourages the wage demands of the unions. It permits the unions to make their demands in the knowledge that they will not cause additional unemployment, or not as much additional unemployment as they would otherwise cause. In other words, the government can have as much, quote, wage push inflation as it is willing to provide an expanding quantity of money to finance. Consequently, the government's expansion of the money supply must be held accountable as the cause of the far greater part of wage push, as the cause of all of wage push, insofar as the phenomenon is continuing and can be associated with the problem of inflation. Now let us turn to a critique of the so-called profit push doctrine. According to the profit push doctrine, prices rise primarily not because wages are rising, but in order to increase the profits of powerful monopolists and greedy big businessmen. It is the push for ever higher profits, say the supporters of this doctrine, that initiates the so-called wage price spiral. The higher prices charged to consumers mean a rise in the cost of living. This rise in the cost of living, say the supporters of the doctrine, is the reason the labor unions demand higher wages. Needless to say, the profit push doctrine is enormously popular with the monopoly labor unions and their numerous supporters. All things considered, it is probably by far the most popular explanation of inflation because, as we saw last week, it is directly suggested by the definition of inflation as rising prices. Now, in fact, the profit push doctrine is subject to all the essential criticisms made of the wage push doctrine, plus some others. It ignores the fact that in the absence of rising demand, rising prices reduce sales volume. That is, they reduce the quantity of goods that can be sold. The prospective loss of sales volume makes even a government-protected monopolist limit his price at some point. I want to consider the case of a government-protected monopolist because that case provides the most plausible context for the profit push doctrine. I will show that the doctrine cannot apply even there. And if it cannot apply there, it obviously cannot apply to any case in which the freedom of competition exists. So let us imagine, for example, a government-franchised electric utility that has been given the exclusive legal privilege of selling electricity in a given geographical area. Such a utility is protected from competition by law. Let us imagine that the rates charged by this utility are not subject to any form of governmental rate regulation. It can set any rate it likes. As I will show, even such a utility would still be limited in what it could charge by the forces of the market. It would not want to charge rates so high as to discourage large numbers of business firms from locating or remaining in its area. It would not want to charge rates so high as to discourage large numbers of homeowners from using electric heat or buying electrical appliances. Clearly, there would be some limit to what such a utility would charge, given the conditions of demand confronting it. Now, the prices charged by this uncontrolled monopoly utility might be considerably higher than the prices that would be charged under the freedom of competition or under governmental rate control. But what it is crucial to realize is that there is absolutely no reason why the utility would want to go on raising its price year after year. Such a monopoly could find it profitable to charge a very high price, perhaps, but not a steadily rising price. Its interest would lie in picking the price that maximized its profits and then sticking to that price. Given the same conditions of demand confronting it, the monopoly would not raise its price in any given year for the same reason that it did not already charge that price in the year before. Namely, it would lose too much business by doing so. In order for the monopoly to find it to its interest to raise its price every year, the conditions of demand confronting it must be changing. People must have a growing ability to pay for its products. But how do the people obtain that ability? One way might be if the prices of other things they bought were falling. This would release funds they previously required for other purposes. But please observe, in this case, the rise in utility rates presupposes a fall in other prices and is strictly limited by the extent of their fall. This case, therefore, cannot be a case of a rise in the general price level. In this case, therefore, the problem of inflation does not even come up. Another way people might be able to afford to spend more for electricity would be if they simply increased their relative valuation of electricity in comparison with the goods they were previously buying. They might decide, or they might just decide, in other words, that they wanted to spend more for electricity and less for other things. But observe, this case means that the rise in demand for electricity is accompanied by an equivalent drop in the demand for other things. The effect of the drop in demand for other things is either to reduce the prices of other things or the supply of other things that is sold. In either eventuality, the problem of inflation, again, does not come up, because we either have no rise in the general price level or one that can only be associated with a decrease in supply. In order for the utility's rate increase to be connected with the problem of inflation, its customers must be in a position to enlarge their spending for electricity without having to reduce their spending for other things. That means they must be in a position to make a larger aggregate demand. Consequently, the only possible explanation of how even protected legal monopolists could raise their prices in a way that is relevant to the problem of inflation is that of growing aggregate demand. Now, I want to stress that with the exception of the cases in which the government violates the freedom of competition, it is a total reversal of things to regard the quest for higher profits as a cause of higher prices. Where the legal freedom of competition exists, that is, where the government does not stand in the way of men competing, the quest for higher profits is always the cause of more supply and lower prices. This is because, under the freedom of competition, firms can earn higher profits only by introducing new and improved products, by finding ways to cut the costs of production, and by keeping the relative production of the various goods properly adjusted to the changing needs and wants of the consumers. As we will see in a later lecture, all of this represents an expansion in production and therefore a tendency toward a lower price level. For the time being, the truth of what I have just said can be grasped on a common sense level simply by realizing that it was nothing but the quest for higher profits that developed all of our industries and built our entire economy over the last 200 years, and that the effect of this industrial development has certainly been to make prices vastly lower than they would otherwise be, because it has radically increased supply. Therefore, the profit motive is, in fact, the source of lower prices, not higher prices. And if we look at what is done with most large profits after they are earned, this conclusion is further strengthened. Most such profits are saved and invested. This, in turn, means more factories, more machines, more stocks of materials. And that means a greater ability to produce, and therefore a larger supply of goods offered for sale. And consequently, again, a tendency toward lower prices, not higher prices. What complicates matters and makes the profit push doctrine appear plausible to many people is that there is a definite association between inflation and a high rate of profit. However, it is not, as most people seem to believe, a rising rate of profit that raises the price level, but an expanding quantity of money and growing demand that increase both the price level and the rate of profit. And I must note immediately that the rate of profit that is increased is not a genuine rate of gain, but merely the rate of profit as expressed in depreciating paper money. That is, it is the nominal rate of profit that is raised, not the real rate of profit. The real rate of profit is the rate that is found after deducting from profits an allowance to cover the loss in the purchasing power of money. increasing demand raises the nominal rate of profit because the costs of business enterprises are necessarily historical. That is, they are incurred prior to the sale of the products. This follows from the fact that production always takes place over a period of time. Materials and labor must usually be bought weeks or months before the resulting product is ready for sale, and sometimes even further in advance. Machinery and factory buildings are bought many years, even decades, before their contribution to production comes to an end. This means that the costs of business enterprises in producing their products represent outlays of money made weeks, months, years, or even decades earlier. To understand the effect of this in conjunction with rising demand, simply imagine a business firm that has laid out some definite sum of money to buy means of production, such as $100. This outlay will later be deducted from the firm's sales revenues. Now, to whatever extent demand in the economy rises, the sales revenues of the average seller will tend to be that much greater. This means that the sales revenues taken in by this particular firm will tend to be that much greater in relation to the $100 it has laid out. Hence, its profits will be greater simply because demand has been growing over time. A good illustration of this process, and one that will enable us to appraise the significance of higher nominal profits, is the case of a hypothetical merchant who normally buys $100 worth of goods on January 1st and sells them the following December 31st for $110. If aggregate demand rises by 10% over the year, this merchant will tend to sell his goods for $121 instead of $110. Consequently, his nominal profit will be increased from $10 to $21. Now, in order to appraise the significance of this higher nominal profit, we must realize that the same increase in aggregate demand that expands our merchant's sales revenues also tends to raise the replacement cost of his inventory. Instead of being able to replace his inventory for $100, as he was able to do in the past, he will now have to replace it at a cost of $110. And this should enable us to see why the whole increase in the merchant's profit is purely nominal, not real. Observe, the merchant's profit rises from $10 to $21. But fully $10 of the additional profit is required merely to replace inventory at higher prices. This leaves the merchant with $11 that he might use for other purposes. But observe further. These $11 will probably buy no more than $10 used to buy because the increase in aggregate demand has probably raised the prices of all the things that the merchant might buy outside his business. So in fact, the $21 of profit the merchant now has represents no more in terms of the merchant's actual wealth and ability to buy goods than the $10 profit he used to have. Indeed, our merchant will actually be worse off as a result of his higher nominal profit. Because apart from other reasons that I cannot go into here, he must pay additional taxes on the additional nominal profit, and must restrict his consumption or new investment in order to do so. To understand this point, assume a tax rate of 50% on profits. Thus, initially, when our merchant made $10 in profit, he paid $5 in taxes and had $5 left to himself, which he could either consume or add to his business. When his profit rises to $21, his taxes rise to $10.50. Of the $10.50 left over, fully $10 are required to replace inventory at higher prices. Therefore, the merchant is left with a mere 50 cents that he can consume or use to expand his business, whereas he initially had $5 and at a lower level of prices as well. Now, exactly the same principles as apply to the profits of our hypothetical merchant apply to the profits of all real-life merchants and to the profits of businessmen in general, because the same kind of increase in nominal profits as occurs on inventories also occurs in the case of depreciable assets such as buildings and machinery. Nevertheless, despite the decline in real profits that it entails, despite the fact that it is an effect, not a cause of inflation, many people, particularly in politics and in the news media, never tire of blaming rising prices on the rise in the nominal rate of profit, and implicitly or explicitly demand that government controls be imposed to limit profits. I must refer to two important instances of this. First, I refer to the campaign that was launched against supermarkets for raising the prices of goods already on their shelves. Because the stores had purchased those goods at prices which had not yet risen, it was assumed that it was some kind of monstrous injustice for them to charge higher prices. The higher prices, it was argued, merely bloated the profits of the supermarkets and were the cause of a higher cost of living for consumers. What those who spread this argument chose to ignore was that the replacement costs of the merchandise had risen, and that if the supermarkets had not raised their prices, they would not have had the means of replacing their inventories. They would have been in exactly the same position as our hypothetical merchant if he had not raised his prices. Assume that our merchant held to his old prices and thus continued to take in only $110, while his replacement cost rose from $100 to $110. His nominal profit that year, based on historical cost, would have remained at $10, and after paying taxes, he would still have had $5. The only problem would have been that even if he had allowed absolutely no dividend for his own consumption, he would have had no more than $105 available for replacing his inventory, while the sum he required for replacement was $110. He would have had to reduce the size of his operations. Exactly this would have been the position of the supermarkets if they had been unable to raise their prices in anticipation of higher replacement costs. It follows that the consumers who wanted cheap goods at the supermarket's expense would have gotten less goods, and if this process were kept up long enough, eventually no goods at all. And paradoxically, at whatever point the control on the nominal rate of profit was finally abandoned, they would have had to pay higher prices than if the control had never been imposed, because prices would then have had to rise on the basis of a decrease in supply as well as on the basis of an increase in demand. The second and far greater campaign against higher nominal profits, greater in its intensity, duration, and injustice, was the campaign against the profits of the oil companies during the oil crisis. In early 1974, every release of a quarterly earnings report by an oil company was an occasion for the New York Times to run a story headlined by a seemingly staggering increase in oil company profits. Day after day, one would read a headline in that newspaper that the profits of oil company X were up 60 or 70% or more over the same quarter the year before. This rise in profits was constantly mentioned in connection with the rise in the price of gasoline and other petroleum products, which had also risen on the order of 60 or 70% over the same period of time. It was constantly implied by the New York Times, by Time magazine, and by a host of television news commentators that the rise in oil company profits was responsible for the rise in the price of oil products. And because the rise in these prices was presented as the cause of practically the whole problem of inflation, the impression was created that the oil companies were out to destroy the country with their insatiable greed for profits. The evasions, distortions, and misrepresentations in this case were enormous. I think they are worth going into because they are a classic illustration of how the supporters of the profit push doctrine argue and what they are capable of. First of all, the supporters of the profit push doctrine evaded two facts that were known to everyone. One, they evaded the fact that the rise in the price of oil products in the United States was the result of a rise in the world price of crude oil, triggered by the Arab embargo and the Arab-sponsored cartel. That is, that it was the result of a rise in the oil company's costs of obtaining imported oil. Two, they evaded the fact that the price of all oil and oil products produced or sold in the United States was totally controlled by the United States government at levels far below their world market prices and at levels which did not even allow the oil companies to pass on more than a part of the higher cost of imported oil. The truth is that our price controls made the importation of foreign oil highly unprofitable, which is one of the major reasons we suffered from a shortage of oil at the time. Furthermore, while the New York Times and the other news media were blaring forth headlines about the enormous rise in oil company profits, they neglected to mention that the profits of the oil companies on domestic production, that is, on oil production within the United States, increased only on the order of about 6% during the crisis period. This was in line with the increase in the physical volume of domestic production. Profits on domestic production did not and could not have increased any more than that because the selling prices of the oil companies were all rigidly controlled by the government in line with their costs of production. The real facts, therefore, are that during the oil crisis, the American market was a very unprofitable market for the importation of foreign oil and a not particularly profitable market for the production of domestic oil. Nevertheless, the news media constantly pointed to a sharp rise in oil company profits and claimed that it was responsible for the rise in prices. Now, to be sure, there was a substantial increase in oil company profits on a percentage basis. Technically, the media were correct in reporting profit increases of 60 and 70% or more. But in representing these profit increases as the cause of higher American oil prices, the media committed four distinct acts of dishonesty or misrepresentation. First, the media neglected to inform the public that these higher profits were not earned on the production or sale of oil or oil products in the United States. In many cases, over half the rise in profits came from inventory profits on stocks of oil and oil products held abroad, where price controls did not apply, and from profits on foreign exchange holdings. The inventory profits were the same in principle as the jump in profits of our hypothetical merchant or of the supermarkets that raised prices in anticipation of higher replacement costs. These inventory profits earned abroad reflected nothing more than that the oil companies possessed some inventories acquired before the rise in the world market price of crude oil and were able to sell the inventories at the higher prices corresponding to the higher replacement price of crude oil. The extra profits earned on the inventories merely served to enable the oil companies to maintain their level of operations, just as was the case with the supermarkets. The profits on foreign exchange holdings were similar. The oil companies are largely international and hold such currencies as Swiss francs and German marks, as well as US dollars. During the oil crisis, the price of the dollar fell in terms of these currencies. This meant that the francs and marks held by the oil companies were suddenly equivalent to a larger number of US dollars. This increase in the dollar value of their foreign exchange holdings was included in the profit gains of the oil companies. The rest of the increase in oil company profits was the result of higher profits on foreign operations, other than profits on inventory or currency holdings, and higher profits on other lines of business, such as the chemical business, in which a large number of oil companies are involved and which had a good year at the time. All of these facts about the sources of the higher profits were simply ignored. The second dishonesty of the media was that they did not point out that even with the 60 or 70% rise in profits of the oil companies, from whatever source, that their profits were thereby only restored to the same level in relation to their sales revenues at which they had existed in 1968. It was not pointed out that the intervening years had been poor ones for the oil industry and that the sharp percentage increase in its profits was largely the result of measuring the increase against an unusually low base. I remember one case in particular in which the headline blared, quote, "2-month earnings soar at Occidental," unquote. It turned out, if one read the article very, very carefully and did some arithmetic that the writer and the editor had not bothered to do, that the soaring earnings represented an increase in profits from about 0.7% of sales revenues to about 5.5% of sales revenues, which was still below normal for the oil industry in previous years. The story appeared, incidentally, in the New York Times of April 11, 1974. Of course, with this type of misrepresentation, it would be possible to write headlines about infinite increases in profits. All one would need would be to find firms that earned some profits in the current period, but which had earned zero profits or incurred losses in the period with which it is compared. The percentage increase would be infinite. Closely related to this kind of dishonesty was a further misrepresentation. In all of the countless times that the news media mentioned 60 or 70% increases in profits in conjunction with 60 or 70% increases in product prices in the petroleum industry, they never once, to my knowledge, mentioned that profits are only a small percentage of prices, 5%, 10%, rarely much more than 10%. This applies both to the petroleum industry and to practically every other industry. Accordingly, it was never pointed out that any given percentage increase in profits must necessarily represent a much smaller percentage increase in prices. If profits are initially 10% of a price, a 70% increase in profits does not equal a 70% increase in price, but only a 7% increase in price. If, as in the case I mentioned, profits are initially 0.7% of the price, even a 1,000% increase in profits would not mean some kind of fantastic increase in price, but a rise merely on the order of a few percent. Thus, even if the oil companies had earned their higher profits in the United States, which they did not, and even if those higher profits had been the cause of a rise in prices, which they were not, they could not have been of any significance as a cause of higher prices. Nevertheless, by the news media's constant conjunction of their roughly equivalent percentage increases, it was made to appear that the rise in profits of the petroleum industry is what accounted for the rise in the prices of petroleum products. Finally, just as the media regularly associated the percentage increases in profits with the percentage increase in product prices, they just as studiously avoided ever mentioning the rate of profit on capital in connection with the rise in the consumer price index. Such a connection would have shown that the oil industry was far from being very profitable in real terms. The reasons are as follows. During the oil crisis, the consumer price level was rising at an annual rate of 13%, while the world's most profitable, most successful major oil company was earning only 18% a year on its capital. This meant that while $100 invested in that company would grow to $118 in a year, it would take $113 at the end of the year to buy what the $100 had bought at the beginning of the year. This meant that the real rate of gain of the owners of that company was less than 5%. It was $5 divided by $113. A real rate of profit of less than 5% for the most profitable, most successful major oil company is quite low. And of course, most oil companies were earning substantially lower real rates of profit. Any oil company whose nominal rate of profit was below 13%, say 8, 10, or 12%, was actually losing money in real terms. But as I say, one never found the media dealing with the real rate of return of the oil companies. Now you may ask where I obtained my knowledge of the facts I have cited. The answer, strangely enough, is the general news media themselves, especially the New York Times. The facts appeared there. They simply received no stress, or they weren't integrated. They were buried in a mass of articles whose headlines and general tenor created exactly the opposite impression. or they appeared at different times in different stories. For example, while the percentage increase in profits over the previous year was carried in headlines, only occasionally, in an almost offhand reference, would one find a mention of the actual nominal rate of profit on capital invested. And while the rate of increase in the consumer price level was featured prominently, it was never mentioned in connection with nominal profit rates, so that one would know what to make of those rates. One would also read statements buried deep in articles denouncing oil company profits that, according to oil company officials or other sources, the rise in profits was largely the result of inventory profits earned abroad and gains on foreign exchange holdings. The statements were never disputed. They were simply ignored as being of no significance. And of course, it was certainly reported in the press that all of the prices charged by the oil companies were controlled by the government, and that the Arabs had brought about a radical increase in the world price of crude oil, which of course meant higher costs to the oil companies. Yet these two facts of fixed prices and radically higher costs, facts which were obviously incompatible with the oil industry being very profitable, were simply ignored in the articles reporting the profit increases, as I discussed earlier. In its reporting on the oil crisis, I am sorry to say, our news media turned in a performance for which I know of no parallel in the journalistic traditions of a free country. I have gone into this matter so deeply because I have wanted to integrate my theoretical attack on the profit push doctrine with the understanding many of you may have had of the facts of the oil crisis. As you can see, an impression that the profit push doctrine explains the rise in oil prices rests on journalistic distortions of the facts. It is probable that similar distortions will occur in the future. Hopefully, you will be on guard against them and will hold in mind the factors we have discussed, such as the source of the profits, their size in relation to sales revenues, the basis of comparison used in showing their change, and the real rate of return on capital. The last variant of the cost-push doctrine to be refuted is what I have called the crisis-push doctrine. By this doctrine, I mean, as I have said, the attempt to blame rising prices on some sudden event that reduces the supply and increases the price of some important good or group of goods. As I have said, the attempt to blame rising prices on the Russian wheat deal in the summer of 1972 or the Arab oil embargo in the fall of 1973 are leading examples of the crisis push doctrine. In the future, it is possible that such events as bad weather, train wrecks, accidental fires, and the like may also be singled out as the cause of rising prices. There are two basic errors in the crisis push doctrine. The first is the assumption that because a crisis can explain a large jump in the price of a particular good, it can explain a correspondingly large jump in the general price level. A crisis can explain a dramatic increase in the price of the particular good in whose supply it takes place, if the good is a necessity. This is undisputed. For example, a few percent reduction in the supply of wheat or oil can cause a dramatic increase in the price of wheat or oil, as the Russian deal and the Arab embargo cartel clearly showed. The inference drawn from this by the supporters of the crisis push doctrine, however, was that these supply reductions could somehow also explain the less dramatic, but nevertheless still very substantial rise in the general price level that was taking place at the same time. That inference was an error. It was an error because not only can a rise in the price of a necessity not explain a rise in the price of other items, but as we saw last week, it actually tends to make the prices of a whole host of other items fall. It has this effect because what makes it possible for people to pay the disproportionately higher price of the necessity undergoing the supply crisis is that they restrict their expenditures for other items. The prices of these other items, therefore, tend to drop. The result is that the overall rise in the general price level is relatively slight, because the dramatic rise in the price of the necessity suffering the supply crisis is largely offset in the average of prices by a mass of other prices that not only do not rise, but many of which actually fall. Because of the widespread declines in prices that would occur, even such a rise in the general price level as a supply crisis could achieve would not qualify for description as a case of inflation, as we discussed last week. The second error of the crisis doctrine is the fact that it confuses what could be the cause of a transitory rise in the general price level with the cause of a permanent, repeated, and indeed accelerating rise in the general price level. A crisis is capable of raising the general price level only in the period in which it reduces supply, and only to the extent that it reduces supply. Thereafter, its ability to raise prices any further is exhausted. Furthermore, almost all supply crises are subsequently solved. And at that point, the effect of a restoration of supply should be to reduce the general price level to its former pre-crisis level. For example, the giveaway of a large part of our wheat to the Russians in 1972 could explain some rise in our price level in 1972 and 1973, a rise corresponding to the fall in aggregate supply that was constituted by the fall in the supply of wheat. But in 1973, there was no repetition of the wheat deal. Therefore, insofar as it depended on the supply of wheat, by 1974, aggregate supply was restored to its former pre-crisis level. And insofar as the supply of wheat was a factor determining the price level should have been restored to its former pre-crisis level. It follows that if we want to explain why prices in 1974 were higher than in 1972, we cannot use such a thing as the crisis in the supply of wheat. The principle here is that all crises that end up being solved, and this includes most of them, can only be causes of temporary increases in the price level. To explain a permanent rise in the general price level on the basis of supply crises, one must assume that as one crisis is solved, another of equivalent magnitude erupts. But if one makes this assumption, one should realize that one cannot then use supply crises to explain a price level that rises from year to year. The effect of an annual repetition of more or less equal-sized crises that are later solved cannot be to raise the price level year after year, because the effect of each new crisis on the price level is canceled by the solution of an old crisis. Consequently, the most that could be explained would be a price level that was higher than it would be in the absence of crises, but not a rising price level. In order to explain a rising price level on the basis of supply crises, one would have to find not only replacement crises for the ones that have been solved, but additional crises as well. And in the next year, one would have to find replacements for this larger number of crises, along with still more additional crises, and this would have to go on from year to year at a compound rate. In order to explain not merely a rising price level, but one that rises with acceleration, one would have to find not only growing supply crises, but an accelerating growth of such crises. I should interject that what makes this doctrine appear plausible to people is that they read about the crises on page 1 while the solutions appear on page 31. So, in the years to come, because of growing irrationality on the part of the government, it is possible that we will have growing supply crises. But the most that these crises could be responsible for in the way of a rising price level would be on the order of a few percent a year. Nevertheless, if they come to pass, prices will almost certainly be rising far more rapidly, perhaps 50 or 100% a year or more. That is because a major form in which the growing irrationality of the government will manifest itself, assuming it actually does occur, will undoubtedly be an accelerating expansion of the money supply. The truth is that operating alongside the largely self-canceling phenomenon of the eruption of new crises and the solution of old crises is the expansion of the quantity of money and rise in aggregate demand. It is this which makes the price level rise far more rapidly than could ever be accounted for by an excess of new crises over the solution of old ones. The root of both errors of the crisis push doctrine is a failure to think on the conceptual level, a failure to go beyond what is immediately, almost perceptually evident. We have just seen that the second error rests on the failure to extend one's field of observation back to the past and forward to the future, to see that the solution of yesterday's crises should now be acting to reduce the price level, and that later on the solution of today's crises should act to reduce the price level in the future, and thus that the real cause of steadily rising prices must be something other than the transitory element of crises. The first error was very similar. It rests on the failure to extend one's field of observation sideways, so to speak, to the goods whose supply is not in a state of crisis, and thus to see that supply crises act to reduce the demand for and the prices of all these other goods, and therefore could simply never account for a very dramatic rise in the general price level, or indeed for that condition of almost universally rising prices which people have in mind when they complain of inflation. At this point, ladies and gentlemen, we have completed the first portion of our refutation of the attempts to deny the quantity theory of money. We have refuted the doctrines that deny that rising demand, itself caused by an expanding quantity of money, is the cause of rising prices. We have seen that the cost push doctrine in general is tantamount to blaming rising prices on falling supply, which we saw last week could not explain the rise in prices. In dealing with the wage push doctrine specifically, we saw that the wage demands of the monopoly unions, unaided by a rising demand, could not go very far before they would burn themselves out in unemployment, and that their effect on prices would be counteracted by increases in the productivity of labor. In dealing with the profit push doctrine, we saw that even government-sponsored business monopolists could not go on raising their prices in the absence of a rising demand for their products. In the absence of more demand, these monopolists might charge very high prices, but not rising prices. We also saw that the only way increases in the demand for their products could be associated with the problem of inflation was to the extent that those increases represented increases in aggregate demand. We then observed that the true effect of the profit motive is to reduce prices, not raise them. Next, we saw that high profits in terms of paper money are not the cause of rising prices, but are themselves an effect of the increase in demand along with the rising prices. Real profits, we saw, actually tend to fall. And finally, we have just seen how wide-ranging, continuous price increases accompanying crises are also the result of rising demand. Next week, we will refute the doctrines that implicitly concede the role of rising demand, but deny that an expanding quantity of money is the cause of it. Thank you.